Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back for another fantastic week in South Africa. This is the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Farmer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how's it going?
Fine, thanks, and yourself?
I'm pretty good, all things considered. And, of course, we're also joined by Mr. Marius Roet. Marius, how are you?
How's it, guys?
And Marius may drop off at the end of our podcast because he's going to be load shed at around 2 o'clock. So, anyway, isn't that wonderful? Okay, so we've got two local stories and two foreign stories today. Let's start off with one of our local ones. This is in connection to the Soweto Tavern shooting, which was happened in July and generated national outrage. I think it's one of the first times that I've really seen crime, at least in a long time, properly dominate the news cycle in South Africa because, you know, South Africans were so desensitized to this stuff. And this tavern shooting and a number of other similar shootings around the country that happened in a short space of time, I think, really generated quite a bit of social attention on the issue of crime and the issue of guns, which all kind of came out to the fore during July and August. So 16 people were killed in this tavern shooting. Apparently, the gunmen used AK-47s and pistols. And recently the police managed to arrest a number of men they say were responsible for the shooting. These men are now appearing in the Orlando Magistrates Court. They've arrested 5 people who are connected to these 16 murders. However, things got pretty tense at the court today when people from the Nomzamo informal settlement, which is just around there, decided to force their way into the courthouse. Courthouse is quite small, and originally they'd only allowed family members and members of the media into the courthouse. And apparently these people from the nearby informal settlement said that they wanted to see who had caused the mayhem in their community, and so pushed the police aside and managed to push their way into the court, which is, I think, we've seen examples of this before in the country, I think most notoriously at Senegal, and this is usually not a very good thing. So Marius, let me start with you. I mean, this just seems like another kind of step in the sort of lawlessness going on in South Africa. Thankfully, it doesn't look like the accused were attacked or lynched or anything like that, but it's still a bit concerning. But yeah, I kind of get why people are so upset because this was a horrific crime and people are so frustrated with the legal system that doesn't seem to often be able to put people behind bars. What do you make of this, Marius?
Well, I mean, it's all part of the broader breakdown in law and order in South Africa, even just this crime itself. I mean, you know, this drive-by shooting, obviously, who knows what it was, if it was a gang-related thing, but obviously, you know, people, obviously, I mean, everybody was probably innocent to one shot, but I mean, obviously people who probably weren't linked to, if it was, say, a gang thing or some kind of hit, then people who were not involved at all were killed. It might have also just been, you know, completely, you know, random attack, and for some reason people decided it'd be a good idea to go shoot up a tavern. But as I say, I mean, people are also losing faith in the justice system in South Africa. You know, polls from various sources show that people are losing faith in the police, but not just the police, but also the broader justice system. And the proportion of people who do have trust in the police and the justice system and so on, it's shown quite a worrying fall off in the last couple of years, you know. So I think as Afrobarometer, who's been tracking this kind of thing for quite a long time, the latest one that I saw from about 2020, so it's quite recent, said something like only about 27% of South Africans actually trusted the police. So that was actually the lowest out of all the various institutions people asked their trust. That was the lowest. People actually even trusted something like Cyril Ramaphosa more than the police, or they even also say, or like broadly politicians and parliaments. The police were actually the least trusted institution in the entire country, including our political institutions. So that tells you something. So this kind of thing, it doesn't surprise me. We've also seen in the number of mob justice attacks that we've seen around the country. And obviously you can't condone a mob justice attack. I mean, those kind of attacks are horrific, and obviously, and often people are killed for just stealing something like a cell phone. But if somebody is living with this threat of crime all the time, and if somebody is, you know, on quite a low income and they can't afford to replace a cell phone, which probably isn't insured, that's maybe their only lifeline to getting a job or whatever the case is, you can understand the kind of anger that comes from, you know, this kind of petty crime. But obviously not to condone any kind of mob justice, but it's all a symptom of the falling up. Mob justice attacks happen because people don't have faith in the police. because they know if they phone the police probably aren't going to come to investigate. They're not going to do anything, even if they catch the guy. They're probably not going to be able to come anyway because they're probably not going to have a vehicle. Even if they do have a vehicle, the vehicle's probably not going to have any petrol or whatever the case is. So it's all, I think these are all symptoms of the broader breakdown in law and order in South Africa.
Yeah, I'm of course reminded of that DA media stunt they did recently where they phoned a whole bunch of police stations around the country and found that about 40% of them didn't have working phone numbers. But there were others that just didn't answer, that did have a working phone number but didn't answer the phone within 2 minutes of calling. And I think that very nicely explains in a quite a practical way just why so few South Africans, less than a third, have any trust in the police services. Herman, what do you make of this? One of the issues that kind of came out to the fore over this was, and this was, there was an op-ed written on this by Media 24 editor-in-chief Adrian Besson, who wrote that firearms and the proliferation of firearms was one of the big causes of this kind of violence, and that we needed to restrict it across, that we needed to restrict firearms more broadly across the country. What are your thoughts on this issue?
Sorry, I just had to mute my microphone because apparently the bloody air show didn't end yesterday, and it should have. Every now and again, there's just, you know, half of the South African Air Force flying overhead.
They get to fly like once a year, like give them a break.
Fair enough, and this guy might have gotten lost, and he's still, you know, looking for the landing strip. So anyhow, but what I do think it is a typical talking point now that to blame this on the guns and the proliferation of guns. And I don't own a gun. I am not particularly a fan of firearms, but you know, ideologically I can completely understand, and philosophically I can completely understand why it is an issue of such importance. And to jump to the conclusion that sort of South Africa's gun laws aren't strict enough, and that the proliferation of firearms into the country through legal means is something that ought to be constrained, or that further legislation or, you know, anything along those lines will actually lead to a reduction in this sort of crime incident, is, I think, naive, terribly, terribly naive. Nick, a year or so ago, you were involved in a fundamental consideration of what were these arguments for of stricter gun control, and the fact is none of them really stand up to serious scrutiny. Now, if we look at the police here, on the one hand, yes, well done, they've arrested a suspect, and the judicial process and the has you know started, but on the other hand, the police force is also responsible in this country for probably being the biggest source of illegal guns and ammunition filtering into the organized crime or the, you know, the black market in the country. So the idea that some sort of systematic structural regulatory response trying to lessen the number of guns on our streets can actually make a difference, I think, is terribly, terribly naive. But I do think the breakdown here of the justice system is incredibly, incredibly depressing. And this is what comes from 2 decades of systematic erosion of trust. Now, the concern about the communities and the crime itself is of course something worth looking at and something that we've looked at. But the storming of the court is something quite different, that these people have no trust in the judicial system to bring justice. And I do think, as Mario said, one understands where this frustration comes from. But where to start reversing this trend is a massive, massive task. Trust once lost in a system is incredibly hard to rebuild. And I remember a few years ago, I was driving between the place outside of Cape Town where I was living to within Cape Town where I was working. And it's a long stretch of road, so you might just as well pick up people who are, you know, wanting to get to the city and so on. And of course, most of them would be domestic workers trying to either at the start of the week or the end of the week, you know, get to where they need to be. And I remember once picking up a lady who, her name was Tandi, and we were driving towards Cape Town, and on the radio there was the usual circus of that time of Parliament, and then she sort of made this comment about the politics going on, and I thought, well, this is a good opportunity for me to engage the subject, and I thought of what she thinks about the state of the country, and she told me that she can't move her left wrist because she was shot in her wrist by her ex-husband, who was a police officer who abused her and was drunk and then shot her in the wrist in Johannesburg here, and she took the kids and fled, and she no longer has the use of her wrist. And then what she said was quite harrowing, and she said that she longs for the days of the early 1980s, when if a crime was committed in a township, the government might actually follow up on that. And, you know, I asked, do you mean like P.W. Buerta and that period? She said, yes, she has great respect for Mr. Buerta and so on. And now the problem is, this is something that Walter E. Williams warned us against very early, you know, late 80s, early 90s, is it'll be a vast indication of failure if the inhumanity of a system is eclipsed by the incompetence of what succeeds it. And that didn't need to happen. The police force didn't need to collapse the way it did. But when you get people like Tandi, really just thinking that she had more trust in the judicial system under P.W. Buerta, well, you know that that your country is very much in many, many aspects scraping the bottom of a very, very tragic barrel.
Maurice, your final thoughts on this topic?
I don't have too much to add. It's, yeah, it's, I think to turn, well, yeah, once, as Herman said, once trust is lost, it's quite a difficult thing to turn things around. It's not impossible, but it's not an easy task either. So, yeah, it's something, that's something, I think for South Africa to succeed, we're going to have to need, you know, security is a vital thing in any successful, prosperous country. And, you know, that means you need to have a fairly well-run police force, which we clearly don't have at the moment.
If I might add something, Nick, at this point, I would like to introduce one of the favorite topics of free marketeers, and that's privatization. I think not necessarily from an economic argument, but private security forces will likely be a key to turning around trust deficit issues, because the system as is, the state system as it is so ingrained.
The ANC, which would shudder at the thought of, would throw up at the thought of a privatized police force, has in some ways, in effect, kind of done that already. Went this out many times, but the number of private security guards in the country is what, at least six times that of the number of police officers. Even though these private security guards don't have, you know, arrest powers and many of the very important things that only the police can do, they still are, I think, a significant factor in kind of holding South African society together, which is not an ideal state of affairs.
And if we want the law and order system to start working, the first question that will need to be asked is, you know, it's a question of the two questions actually that run, you know, neck and neck in terms of importance is, number one, which entities can on short notice very immediately and very effectively start keeping communities safe and following up on criminal complaints and so on. And the other question is, which entities will be trusted by these communities to do that? And by, you know, mere elimination of possibilities, you get to a point where some form of a collaboration between massive private sector involvement, community policing platforms, that really offers your only route to satisfying those two questions, because the police and the government and the state has so fundamentally lost the trust here that they might regain it down the line, but they won't start. A change of government, a change of policy would really need a creative approach to getting entities that can do something and that can be trusted to do something into these communities suffering the worst.
Although I do think that any future government's first priority on day one is to begin reforming and fixing the police, because without that, not much is going to get done in almost every other sector. Okay. Let's move on to our next topic today. And this is just some interesting developments within the ANC's internal leadership contest. So they're going to an elective conference at the end of the year, December, where President Cyril Ramaphosa is going to face at least one challenge to his leadership of the ANC. And I'm interested to see that we did talk about this a little bit, I think a week or two ago, but that NDZ, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, appears to have not really featured in the KwaZulu-Natal ANC's consideration of who they're going to put up to challenge Ramaphosa. And in fact, Zweli Mkhize is coming out now pretty decisively as leading the nominations amongst ANC branches and regions in the KwaZulu-Natal province, which is still one of the ANC's most important provinces electorally, ever since the Zuma years. Internally, ever since the Zuma years, the province's power has been greatly increased. And, it looks like, KZN is going to properly Zweli Mkhize. Some people who were interviewed by the sort of anti-Ramaphosa media, I'm thinking IOL in this case, quoted senior members of the ANC and KZN saying, you know, we supported Comrade Dlamini Zuma and campaigned for her in 2017, but dynamics have changed, and we now believe that Mkhize would help us a lot when he takes over the presidency. This is, I believe, despite the fact that Dlamini Zuma was still endorsed for this electoral conference by Jacob Zuma, which perhaps suggests that he is a bit of a fading light on the anti-Cyril Ramaphosa faction side there. Herman, what do you make of all this?
Well, I must say the fascinating thing is that Jacob Zuma does seem to be by far the most popular politician in KwaZulu-Natal, comfortably from you know the polling data that we've seen. So I think the problem here is that the Zuma faction without the bully pulpit of the presidency really struggles to win the argument in public. I think not enough people knew of Zuma's endorsement of Dlamini Zuma. Otherwise, her fate might have been different in these small local contests. But it is a very 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 schizophrenic image of the ANC that's starting to emerge. You almost have two or even three ANCs starting to emerge. You've got the KwaZulu-Natal ANC, but within that you've got the question, is it in Mkhize faction, is it in Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma faction, and is Mkhize representative of neither the Ramaphosaites, the Zumaites, and therefore a third faction that is, you know, biding its time or coming into existence now? So that's the first question, is if Mkhize does in fact carry KwaZulu-Natal in a way, whether he wins the presidency or not, the question would be, why did he carry KwaZulu-Natal in the first place? Was it Ramaphosa supporting him? Well, if so, then why didn't KwaZulu-Natal go for Ramaphosa? So KwaZulu-Natal, the ANC, is in a weird situation, because if Ramaphosa controlled it, they would support him, but they didn't. If Zuma controlled it, they would support Dlamini Zuma, but they didn't. So they are supporting Mkhize, and that might either be a genuine organic appeal that the man has to the ANC on the ground there, or it is something of a 84 dimensional chess game going on here.
Right. Mkhize did, I believe, run for ANC president last time as the kind of compromise candidate, but didn't seem to get anywhere.
Yes.
Kind of got pushed aside by the whole thing. It's interesting. I think, Morris, what do you make of these developments? Do you think we should read too much into them? Cyril seems much weaker than he was a year or two ago. You know, a year or two ago, I would say there's no chance that Zweli Mkhize would be able to maybe win the presidency of the ANC. But now, I don't know, maybe he'll be able to give Ramaphosa a run for his money. What do you make of it?
No, I'm not sure he will. Most provinces, I think so far, each of the provinces they have announced who they're supporting, except for KwaZulu-Natal, is back to Ramaphosa. So I think the real race will be between kind of Ramaphosa candidates versus RET candidates, whatever you want to call it, in the rest of the top six. So I think Ramaphosa is probably pretty safe overall, I think. I mean, a week's a long time in politics, so it's still going to be a while till the national conference. So I think, yeah, I think there'll be a lot of proxy battles in the, who's in the top six and who gets elected to the NEC and stuff. So that's probably what you're really going to have to watch. But also shows you the brazenness of the ANC, especially in KwaZulu-Natal, where Zweli Mkhize came out with one of the biggest corruption scandals, which actually says quite a lot in the last couple of years. And he's still the, favorite candidate in KwaZulu-Natal. And I mean, Zweli Mkhize really, he dug his own grave, because he was, before all this came out, a lot of people are, you know, saying this is probably the next president of South Africa, you know, and before all this came out, he's a man, like, he comes across with a sense of gravitas and so on. You know, he's not a buffoon like a lot of other ANC politicians, Fikile Mbalula, for example, or Carl Nias or Tony Ngeni, these kind of guys. He seemed like a person who was actually considered and, you know, was thoughtful and so on. But then obviously all this stuff came out and he was forced to resign, which in itself is actually quite big for an ANC politician to actually resign from a government post because of...
Right, he's one of the only who's resigned recently.
So it shows you the depth of the scale of corruption that he was doing. And yeah, I mean, before this all happened, I remember the Financial Mail named him there personally, yeah, in 2020, I think. And they put him on the cover with this, his silhouette with his cape as if he was some sort of superhero who'd saved South Africa, like coming out behind him because he'd obviously handled COVID so well in theory. You know, so it tells you a lot. I mean, as I say, I don't think Ramaphosa himself was going to be under too much pressure though, but the real race to watch is going to be who's the rest of the top six and the NEC and so on. But I mean, the fact that the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal has also gone for Zweli Mkhize, who's got, you know, these kind of corruption, this corruption stuff that he's been involved in and so on, shows you that I think the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal is, you know, it's really on its way out. I'd be very surprised if the ANC manages to hold on to KwaZulu-Natal in the next election. So yeah, it's going to be something to watch.
On that point, it's fascinating that, there would be this massive contest as to who controls KwaZulu-Natal's ANC, while in KwaZulu-Natal itself, in those recent spate of by-elections, the ANC is deteriorating at a remarkable rate. So there is a question of the ANC. For a long time in South African, the only game in town was who's in control of the ANC, but that does seem to start shifting. And something that we shouldn't miss is the fact that up until now, as far as I can remember, we've only ever had two serious contenders for the presidency, going back to Zuma versus Mbeki, then later Motlanthe versus Zuma, then Ramaphosa versus Dlamini Zuma. This is the first time you have people with their hats in the ring that, you know, it's sort of, if Ramaphosa is weaker than he's ever been before, you've got Mkhize who might have this powerful a province behind him. You've got Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, who clearly has national infrastructure. But then you've also got Paul Mashatile, who is actually a well-regarded ANC guy from Gauteng, with the weight pads of the Gauteng caucus behind him. So it really is showing that the fracturing of the ANC, perhaps 10 years overdue by you know, the Alistair Sparks expectation, we might genuinely be heading in that direction, purely for the fact that the coherence of the thing breaks down because which faction gets to lead becomes too difficult to tell because there are so many factions.
Mm-hmm. And we've also had Julius Malema endorse Paul Mashatile as leader of the ANC. So there you go. Okay, let's move on to our next topic. And Italy has just held an election. They had a big political crisis over the last couple of years. And as a result, they've had to call an election, and in quite a reversal from the previous election in 2018, I think it was, the parties have changed position quite a lot. It looks like the center-right, right-wing coalition is going to come to power and win a majority of seats. The biggest party were the Brothers of Italy, which got in the sort of mid-20s. The second party was the kind of social democratic party on the left. And, there's a couple of other parties, Lega, or the Northern League, I think is the English translation of their name, who previously were the second biggest party, have dropped down quite a few places, in the electoral results. We've also had Silvio Berlusconi, who was previously a prime minister of Italy, managed to come in, I think, third within the right-wing coalition there, and so he's going to form part of the new government, presumably. Berlusconi just is a fascinating character if you're looking at politicians with scandals. You should just go and have a look at the Wikipedia page about all of the scandals he's had over his long political career, and it would make Zuma blush in the sort of legal troubles space, because man, this guy is, he's also, I think, been injured in the most Italian way I've ever heard of, which is someone during a rally once hit him with a marble statue, but that's neither here nor there. So anyway, It looks like the centre-right have won. The turnout was pretty low in this election. They won partly on campaigning on crime. The Brothers of Italy have been described by some as a far-right party, although they've very much tried to make paint themselves as a centre-right party. They were previously very anti-European Union, but have actually softened their stance in recent years. They previously wanted, for example, to leave the euro. However, they no longer hold that view. One of the big issues that came out during the Italian election, one of the sort of shocking events, was a Nigerian migrant who was strangled to death by an Italian man. And the Italian man claimed it was because the Nigerian was begging incessantly. And this was filmed. And it caused a big stir in Italy. But interestingly, despite the fact that this was a murder of a migrant by an Italian man, it doesn't seem like the issue got framed as a racist attack. Although that's what many on the Italian left said, the Italian right managed to frame it as a sort of lawlessness question and say, look, what's happened here is the breakdown of law and order and that how crime has gotten out of control and how people just feel like they can do what they want. And that seems to, I think, from my very limited understanding of Italian politics, played a little bit of a role in coming together, bringing the right-wing coalition over the top. But really, this is, Italy has very contentious, difficult politics. And I wonder how long this new government will last. Marius, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, I think this is kind of a pattern we're seeing in Europe. Sweden just had elections a couple of weeks ago, and a party called the Sweden Democrats is also pretty anti-immigrant, also has its roots in actually in some neo-Nazi organizations. It's got 20% of the vote. It's probably going to be part, at least supports the new governing coalition. But as I think this is a pattern across Europe where people are kind of moving away from the old established parties. In Germany's election last year, the two biggest parties, the Christian Democrats and Social Democrats, didn't even win 50% of the vote between them. And it's not even necessarily people are moving towards these right-wing populists. We saw what happened in Sinn Féin, in Ireland, rather. Sinn Féin is now the biggest single party in both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And nobody would call Sinn Féin right-wingers. I mean, they're definitely left-wingers. People in general are moving away from, like, the kind of establishment parties. France is another example. We've seen the left-wing populists and right-wing populists do pretty well in the legislative elections that France had in May, I think. And Marine Le Pen wasn't actually that far from beating Emmanuel Macron to the presidency of France. So, I think we'll have to wait and see what this means. I don't think this means we're going to suddenly see a fascist government arise overnight in Italy. With the proportional representation system, I think there's kind of will be tempered and so on. And I think some of the people in the coalition government, I mean, Silvio Berlusconi is probably the moderate guy that's going to be part of this coalition. But I just want to quickly read you guys something about the new Prime Minister of Italy. So it says, Meloni is an avowed fancy of, this is from Wikipedia, Meloni is an avowed fan of fantasy, particularly Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, which he called a sacred text. As a youth activist with the Italian social movement, which is the Italian fascists, she attended Hobbit Camp and sang along with the extremist folk band Compagnia dell'Anello, named after Fellowship of the Ring. Later she named a political conference at Treu after the year of the novel The Neverending Story. And apparently in Italy, the far right has traditionally associated itself with fancy, which it considers to share its vision of spirituality against materialism. So I thought that's some interesting stuff about the new Prime Minister of Italy. So
no, that's really interesting. I'm just imagining the Italian fashion Lord of the Rings music.
Cosplay. Lord of the Rings cosplay.
And of course, this is partly because I suspect that the Italians like it because the Italian right is very Catholic, and J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of Lord of the Rings, was very devout Catholic whose writings were informed by his faith. But Herman, what do you make of all this?
Well, I'm a Protestant that holds Tolkien in high regard. I must say, if you want to be a fascist a dictator, perhaps don't base your political identity on hobbits. Just a hint. I don't think it strikes so much fear into the heart of the opponents as people think. I must say what's very interesting to me about this is two main considerations. There's no getting away from the fact that the Brothers of Italy is the sort of legacy party of fascist movements from the 1940s and 50s. There's no getting away from that fact. It's sort of like the DA today is the descendant of the PFP of yesteryear. So too the Brothers of Italy today share this, you know, legacy of clear Italian fascism. The other point that I want to make is that I get incredibly frustrated when the term far right is just is just lobbied about without any real consideration or criticism. Now, I don't count myself an expert on Ms. Maloney at all, but I've read a few interviews with her over the last 2 days or so, and she strikes me as what, you know, 10, 15 years ago would have been mainstream Western conservatism. The idea that you are skeptical of gay rights, the idea that you hold the traditional family in high regard, law and order, very heavy issue. These aren't liberal issues, certainly, but they are conservative issues, most definitely. But I sort of struggle to see how that automatically qualifies her as far right. And I think it's annoying and unhelpful that we immediately go, oh my goodness, Berlusconi, oh, not Berlusconi, Mussolini is back because, you know, far right. Let's actually look at what these people are doing. It's annoying and it doesn't help anyone.
I must just say the funniest moment of this entire election was when because the Brothers of Italy were leading in the polls and it looked like the right-wing coalition was going to take power. And so I think it was the Associated Press ran with the headline, Italy set to elect first far-right prime minister in its history. Of course, this is the country which invented fascism and whose prime minister, Benito Mussolini, was somewhat notorious for being a bit of a fascist.
And I still blame that bold idiot for risotto. What an awful, awful dish to admit. I mean, he did other evil stuff too, don't get me wrong, but risotto is one of his enduring legacies.
Why are you bringing up something so controversial at the end of the show? Anyway, we don't have time to discuss the merits of risotto, but thank you very much for listening. We hope that you found this interesting, and we will, of course, be back tomorrow with the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.